J.R.R. Tolkien wrote a book back in the 1930s during the Depression, and it was called The Hobbit. Now, the more famous book he wrote, or the series that came after that, was Lord of the Rings. And they are connected in various ways. They became very well known. Lord of the Rings is read in many of our school systems, in the grade school level, and obviously became a movie series as well. But The Hobbit was a creature about 3 feet tall. And I guess some of the hobbits lived in the ground, and some of the hobbits lived in caves and little shelters. And it's kind of a fanciful creature. But it's interesting that they have a creature that they have found more recently that they have also nicknamed the Hobbit. So at least we now have evidence that indeed one of these things did exist. I'd like to read you a little bit from an article that was produced in that regard. I did see it in the paper this morning as well, different article in the Spokesman Review, so it's at least hitting the news. It says, when she died 18,000 years ago on what is now the Indonesian island of Flores, the tiny 30-year-old female known only as LB1, can you imagine naming her that, had grown to what scientists believe was an average height for her kind, 3 feet 4 inches tall. So they found a skeleton of a hobbit-like creature that's a little over 3 feet tall, and it's kind of sent the anthropological world on its ear. They're very excited. That is one more chance to discount any possibility of normalcy in terms of what creation would account for, at least from their perspective. So their head and brain measured just a third of the size of modern humans. In the soil around her bones, anthropologists found signs of intelligence and a primitive culture. That would include charred animal bones. That's a sign of intelligence. That means they caught the animal on fire, I suppose. Charcoal and crude stone tools. You know, even little rock flakes would be a crude stone tool. Sign of intelligence. They quickly dubbed the find hobbits, and that sent shockwaves to the world of evolutionary science. Detailed comparisons of the skulls of LB1, because they actually found more than one skeletal portion there, and they compared it to chimpanzees, and it strongly suggests that the Homo floresiensis is not a random microcephalic. You know what a microcephalic is. That's about what I was when I was a baby. A microcephalic means you just got a small head. But instead, it's a distinct and now extinct species. They did some scans on the skeletal pieces they found, and they decided that it had a very highly developed brain, had some of the same wrinkles that normal human brains have. They found a deep groove that separates the brain lobes, and there's parts of the brain they've determined that are able to understand speech and hearing, and they've gone through, it's a very technical study in that respect. All of this points to heightened intelligence and one big puzzle. How, experts wonder, could Homo floresiensis be smart, as these brain characteristics and local signs of cooking and tools suggest, and yet have a brain the third size of ours? We have other questions, too. Well, how do they get to the Flores? It's an island, by boat. So they pointed out that even during the low water mark of the last ice age, the island remained separated from other islands and the mainland by at least 12 miles of deep water. Nobody knows exactly why this small creature died off 13,000 years ago, but it's said that they appeared to hunt the stegodon, which is a miniature elephant. So you have these hobbits on this island hunting little hobbit elephants, and I suppose wearing hobbit cowboy boots and elephant hide cowboy boots, and all in miniatures. I guess my point and my concern is, when I read this, is not that indeed some bones have not been found that have some significance, but it's the way those things are processed. Someone finds a small skull and some charred animal bones and some chipped up crude stone tools, and they determined that it was a sign of intelligence. A chipped, flaked up piece of stone is clearly and obviously a sign of intelligence. Somebody had to make it. And then they look at the hobbit and they say, but indeed, this creature absolutely came into being by chance. And it is astounding to me. They rode boats to the islands, they hunted miniature elephants, they wore miniature cowboy boots, but they came into being by chance. But the stone tool, the chip that is laying there by the bones, was not. That is a sign of intelligence. They have a theory as well as how the hobbit-like creature's language may be developed and what came to be. A linguist who has studied in that area, John McWhorter, found that some of the people on the island of Flores, by coincidence, spoke a very simple language. Most languages are not simple. They become very complex, and they have lots of grammar rules, and they have lots of modifications. And you have to memorize things to learn and study that language. But a couple of the languages that are used on this island of Flores are more simple. They're simpler than pretty much anyone else. And so he had a hypothesis, which he admitted to kind of cover himself, was highly tentative. But he said, probably, or likely, or possibly, when normal modern humans came in contact with the hobbits were subjugated in some way to the humans and became servants or in some way helpers, and they, hobbits repeated the language of the humans in a very simplified form. The children of the humans listened to the hobbits' language and picked it up and passed it on as a pidgin language, and that survived on down to our day. Now, that is very impressive. Aren't theories great? You know, take a theory, as they used to say, in 2 bits, and you could buy a cup of coffee. Actually, now that would be $4 if you go to Starbucks. Remarkable world. What man considers a sign of intelligence and what they do not is indeed astounding. Edge Foundation every year asks a question to various scientists and authors and thinkers in our culture, and then they publish the results. And the current question is, what do you believe is true even though you cannot prove it? And predictably, a number of the answers were, well, I really don't believe that God is true even though I can't absolutely prove it. I simply know that it is true. I want to read you a couple of the answers that were posted on their website, the Edge website. This is from an anthropologist from a university and an author. He says, there is no God that has existence apart from people's thoughts of God. There is certainly no being that can simply suspend the laws of the universe in order to satisfy our personal or collective yearnings and whims, like a stage director that's called on to change or to improve a play. Now, the answers are longer than what I'm giving you. I've simply pulled a few of the comments out. Here's a publisher of Skeptic Magazine. You might wonder what his opinion would be. Columnist, also writes Scientific American. There is no such thing as the paranormal and the supernatural. There's only the normal and the natural and mysteries that we have yet to explain. You know, like where that language came from that the human children were learning from the hobbits who learned it from their parents. There is no God, intelligent designer, or anything representing the divinity as preferred by this world's religions or by the world's religions. Morality is the natural outcome of evolutionary and historical forces, not divine command. The moral feelings of doing the right thing, such as virtuousness, or doing the wrong thing, such as guilt, were generated by nature as part of human evolution. I'm reading these, and I'm tying it in with some of the scientific discovery because there is a philosophy that lies at the heart of this attitude and approach. Here's an individual who's a media analyst, a writer, author. It's hard for people to contend with the great probability that we are simply over-advanced fungi. Is it fungi or fungi? It's like that. I've heard the joke so many times about the fungi that walked into the bar and he got kicked out. He says, "Why? I'm a fun guy." But I can't remember now which word was the original. But anyway, he says, "And we're simply over-advanced fungi and bacteria hurling through the galaxy in cold and meaningless space. Our existence may be unintentional, meaningless, and purposeless. But that doesn't preclude meaning or purpose from emerging as a result of our interaction and collaboration." You see, purpose is something in this person's eyes, and in many others, frankly, that develops out of random process. Meaning may not be a precondition for humanity, but rather a byproduct of it. Richard Dawkins, some of you will recognize his name in terms of his writings. He's an evolutionary biologist, Oxford University, and an author, famous in that field. He says, "I believe that all life, all intelligence, all creativity, and all design," and he puts design in quotes because there's an argument today that design proves the existence of a higher intellect and being. Obviously, from a Christian's point of view, that would be God. They leave the implication out specifically in the design argument, but that's what he's contending with. "All design, anywhere in the universe, is the direct or indirect product of Darwinian natural selection. It follows that design comes late in the universe after a period of Darwinian evolution. Design cannot precede evolution and therefore cannot underlie the universe." I think it's interesting. I began to read through Intelligent Design and some of the writers and who they were contending with, some of the evolutionary writers. And at the base of evolution, and at the base of the scientific discovery that supports evolution and natural selection as means by which this creation has come to the point to where it is, there is a fundamental argument that is being made. That argument is, there is no God. But even more than denying God, what the denial is, there is no inherent law. Because if God made no law, they would not need to refute and ignore and put God away. If God simply made the creation and walked away and no law was in place, then it would not even be an issue. The issue is law. If there is God, there is a law. If he's the creator, then he has rule over the creation, and thereby we must respond accordingly. That is the fundamental driving force behind the theory of evolution, and again, the material that is supportive of that in many scientific circles today. Romans 1, verse number 16. We have a booklet, Life's Ultimate Question, Does God Exist? We've had material in years past, 7 proofs that God exists. And we have argued very strongly from the theory, from the position of design references a designer. Creation demands a creator. And that you can see God's fingerprints in the creation. You can see the evidence of organization and intelligence in that which we see around us. It is very much a biblical understanding and concept when it's put in a scriptural place. Romans 1 and verse number 16. Paul says, "I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes. For the Jew first and also for the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith." Then he says he draws a contrast to responding to God and living by faith and being obedient to God. "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them." The word manifest means to make evident, to make known. The manifest destiny was the obvious destiny in the way that was portrayed to the people of our land in that day. "Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them.
How did God show them his presence? How did God show them that he was there? He showed us in the creation. He showed us in the design and the handiwork of his hands. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, intelligent design in part, even his eternal power in Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Paul is saying that you don't have to sit down and read the scriptures specifically to recognize that God exists. That you can look at the creation and know that these things are true. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful. But they became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. They didn't want to believe in God. They tried to find something other than a belief in God. They actually created and produced things that would defend their disbelief in God. And that's what evolution is. Professing to be wise, they became fools. And they changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man. Birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. It's also referencing, obviously, that which is idolatry and that which man has invented for himself to worship. Some people worship their science. Some people worship their own hands. Therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness and the lusts of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. You know, it portrays this attitude of individuals who want indeed to deny God, who try to deny God, and yet they will do so in a way that is justifiable in their eyes. And they teach others to do the same. God said that his hands are seen, his fingerprints are on the creation. And we have taught that and expressed and explained that in our literature over the years. Some of what I want to address today in this is not going to repeat what is in our own books, booklets, or what Mr. Armstrong had written as well. Remember A Whale of a Tale? Way back when, I remember the young ambassador singing about that. I remember so many of those booklets I have in my library, at least at home. So some of what I want to address today might overlap slightly with that, but more of it is issues and matters and illustrations that are used more commonly today. Look at Jeremiah 10, though, first. Again, describing the creation and God's explanation on how he has put his fingerprints in our sight. Jeremiah 10 and verse number 12. He has made the earth by his power. He has established the world by his wisdom. Wisdom would include intelligence. In other words, you're going to see things. It's just like when that anthropologist looks at a rock chip and he recognizes this had to be made by someone. This did not just happen. And yet the hobbit just happened. But the rock chip is a sign of intelligence. That hobbit probably had more intelligence than some of the people who analyzed the remains. It says, he has established the world by his wisdom and has stretched out the heavens at his discretion. When he utters his voice, there is a multitude of waters in the heavens. He causes the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth. He makes lightning for the rain. He brings the wind out of his treasuries. So it actually goes beyond just saying, you know what, the wind, that's just a natural process. And it operates significantly on its own. And the rain, well, that's just a chemical process in some part. It's a physical process, and the rain is vapor that condenses up in the sky around pieces of dust and comes back down on our ground. It goes beyond that, and it talks. And I know it's speaking in colorful language, but it says he causes this to happen. He makes lightning. He brings the wind. His hand is in the process. We were having a discussion at the Bible study in Coeur d'Alene this week of what's happening in Lebanon and how things happen over the course of time historically that are prophetically significant. And we got to discussing the Battle of Waterloo and how it was that Napoleon lost that battle. Now, I saw it on TV one time, and it was interesting because I've read about Napoleon. Napoleon was an artillery man who knew how to look at the enemy line and find the weakest spot. He had a gift for looking at the enemy defenses and finding where the weakness was. And what he would do is he would then center his artillery to blow a hole in the line at that spot, and then he would charge his soldiers through the hole, divide the enemy line, and attack and win the battle. And so he had this intelligence and this gift and the capacity to do so, and he built his fighting and army around that tactic. And so at the Battle of Waterloo, as he is facing off now, and I think it was the British soldiers, I would have to go back and remember exactly, were on a little bit of a rise, and the soldiers were down behind the top of this small hill. And so Napoleon now is facing them, and they were going to be reinforced within a few days by another army coming in. They would greatly strengthen their ranks, and he knew that the battle had to be won at that point. He began to fire his artillery at the point on this little rise where he knew that his troops would have to break through, and he never was able to bring down the artillery in a way that was effectively sufficient to blow that hole and to win that battle. And you know why? Because it rained. It rained. The cannonballs that would hit short of the troops, it had rained to the point to where they would embed themselves in the mud and blow up and be muffled, and the damage simply was not able to be done. The troops were laying where the shots that were fired over their heads landed behind them, and again, not effectively able to blow that line in a way to bring his soldiers through. And when he finally sent the cavalry in a desperate charge, again, the field was so full of mud that the ability to advance was insufficient to break that line. He lost the Battle of Waterloo. In other words, he was able to do what he was able to up until the point to where prophetically that would not be profit of what God's plan was to be fulfilled. You can look at Alexander the Great the same way. You can look at so many things historically. He lost the Battle of Waterloo because it rained. Now, God says here, he causes the vapors to ascend. He makes lightning for the rain and brings the wind. He fulfills his purpose. Science looks at those events and say, what a remarkable circumstance or coincidence or happenstance that indeed truly was. Nehemiah, chapter 9, verse number 6. We have another account here, real short in this respect, but again, a reference to the way God works. Nehemiah 9, verse 6. You alone are the Lord. You have made heaven, the heaven of heavens, and all their host. Says he made it. He put this in place according to his purpose. The earth and all the things that are in it you made, it says, the seas and all that is in them, and you preserve them all. The host of heaven worships you. So just as you made all these things, and not only that, you preserve it. You maintain it. There are other scriptures that basically would say directly that if indeed the creation was not maintained by the power of God, it would cease to exist. Matter's not eternal. I tend to think of a rock as if you just set it there and went away, that it would never, never disappear. Now, the minute God stops maintaining the universe, that rock would disappear. The universe came into being out of nothing, it says, by God's power. God, through his power in the Spirit, made the physical. And should God ever stop to maintain the physical, it would cease to exist. It's an amazing concept. But God's fingerprints are all over his creation. We live in a secular society that uses religious terminology, but our society operates without absolutes in many, many respects. One of the things that was happening this week, again, we discussed it at our Bible study in Coeur d'Alene, the Supreme Court heard arguments in support of the Ten Commandments. Well, not exactly in support of the Ten Commandments, in support of public monuments that portray the Ten Commandments. The hearings were not about whether or not to keep the Ten Commandments. They weren't about the Fourth Commandment, the Sabbath, or the sixth commandment, or the seventh commandment, or the tenth. There's no hearings about not coveting or not killing or any such thing. It was the Supreme Court who legalized abortion in the first place, obviously. So the issue is not the Ten Commandments, the issue is the portrayal of these effectively as icons. We preach the gospel to a society that doesn't even know what the commandments are. And we will not be able to always just preach chapter and verse. And so sometimes in our relationships in this society, we have to be able to simply state our argument or our defense in ways that they can specifically understand. 1 Peter 3:15. We've used this very readily. It's an important verse. Sanctify, set apart, you know, for God's service, the Lord God in your hearts. And always be ready to give a defense. Doesn't say necessarily that it's a chapter and a verse. People who don't even read their Bible don't particularly care what chapter and verse might indeed say. But be always ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. So we ought to have in our tool bag, in that sense, in the preaching of the gospel, information where we can argue with, in a right way, the skeptic, if indeed he would listen. We cannot convince anyone, obviously, against their will. One of the ways to declare God's presence to a secular society is through the argument of intelligent design. It's not a new argument. William Paley, in 1802, wrote about finding a watch out in the field, and that was encountered in various ways. But he used the analogy of this watch, and if you found it in the field, what would you assume? We would assume, indeed, that an intelligent being had produced it, and it had been left there. And there is nothing else that we would assume. The theory of evolution came after that, and basically shattered in many scientists' eyes the arguments that he had made. Currently, we speak of setting a monkey at a typewriter. If you put a monkey at a typewriter, how long would it take before, would he eventually, if he could live forever, would he eventually type out the Encyclopedia Britannica word for word? No. But evolutionary thought indicates, indeed, someday, eventually, in eternity, he would. No, he would never, ever type out the Encyclopedia Britannica. He would never even write a letter to his mother. It would never take place. The analogy is used of a tornado in a junkyard. If you had an airplane junkyard and you had a tornado go through there every single day forever, how long would it take to make a B-57? Is there a B-57? 747? 757? B-42? B-52? Thank you, John. You could never, ever, in eternity, produce a plane out of a tornado in a junkyard. So those arguments by design are basically the same. Michael Behe argues against Darwinian evolution with the concept of irreducible complexity. And I've addressed that some years back in a different argument. I want to give you an illustration of that today. He studies the functioning of life at the cellular level, but he has a simpler analogy that he uses as well. It's the analogy of a mousetrap. Mousetrap has a flat wooden platform or base. And I was going to find a mousetrap this morning, and I just forgot. We ran out of the house this morning, as usual, as I'm late. But mousetrap has a flat wooden platform or base. It is a metal hammer which crushes the mouse, that little spring, not the spring, but that arm that comes over and snaps that mouse. It has a spring with extended ends that power the hammer. Okay, you can picture a very simple mousetrap. It is a catch that releases the spring. So there's a catch that holds that thing extended, and a metal bar that connects to the catch and holds the hammer back. So, you know, there's a catch, there's a metal bar that goes over the mouse smasher part and a spring and a base, that's a mousetrap. Very, very simple. Now, according to the Darwinian theory of natural selection through evolution, What you would do is you'd take the platform and you'd catch a couple of mice. And then you would add a spring and catch some more. And then you would add a holding bar and a catch and catch a few more mice. And then finally, when you had this thing already in place, you'd catch everything you wanted. Now, the evolutionists would disagree with that. They would say, no, you would take the wooden piece and it would be a paperweight. It wouldn't catch mice, but it would function at some level. And you could take the little metal bar and you could catch fish with that. And then you could take, or you could take the spring piece with the little metal part on it and use it as a tie clasp. Or you could, you know, and they'd go on and say, it's useful for something, but you don't catch mice until it's all in the right place. You know, I cannot believe that intelligent human beings argue those issues. Capable people, apart from the desire to absolutely deny that there is a God. They have to have incentive to argue in that way. Because if you take that same, that's just an analogy, take that with blood clotting, which is what Michael Behe also does. Blood clotting is a chemical process where everything has to work at once. You cannot have blood and then just start clotting somewhere down the line. And when the blood clots, it has to clot precisely the way it needs to, not too much, or your blood doesn't move, and not too little, or it does no good. So the fact is, there is no incremental way to get there, and then everything works as you go. The argument of irreducible complexity is an argument of design. Everything has to work all at once. William Dembski is another well-known author in this field. He argues against Darwinian evolution with the concept of specified complexity. Now, I know that some of this is a little bit technical, but at the same time, I think if indeed we are going to argue that evolution is not rational and logical and reasonable and scientific, that they won't always be able to say because the Bible says so. Because everyone indeed isn't going to be focused on that level. I think it would help us to understand some arguments in regard to intelligent design. I think it's arguments that we use in our booklet. It's arguments Mr. Armstrong used in his. And it would help for us to have a bit of that concept to be able to grasp as well. Specified complexity deals with the ability, again, to recognize intelligence. Have you ever seen the groups of radio telescopes that are the receiving dishes, actually, listening for radio waves, SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence? And so they have these discs out there, these listening devices, where they're searching for radio waves coming from somewhere out in the universe. And they take all the noise that comes in and they run them through computers, and they look for patterns in the noise that would show them that there is intelligent life somewhere out there. And the argument William Dembski makes is that noise that they get has to have a certain level of complexity. There has to be a pattern, and the pattern has to be complex enough where it shows that it's intelligence that it was required to put that out. And it also has to be specified. There has to be some purpose behind it. If the signal came through with a pattern, but the pattern was very simple and there was no purpose behind it, then we would not necessarily be convinced that that was intelligence. Think of it differently. Do anybody remember Pioneer 10 and 11 spacecraft? Okay, where are they? They're out there floating along out there in the solar system. Now, Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft passed those spacecraft by. They were all launched, I think, in the 70s. And now Voyager 1 and 2 are out there in interstellar space. They flew past all the planets, and they're out there now waiting to be discovered by somebody. But you know what they put on those spacecraft that would have to do with specified complexity? Now, the spacecraft is specified complexity by itself. But no, on the first ones, we had a plaque. Do you remember this drawing of a man, and then showing where we came from in the solar system and these, you know, out there and stretched out. Well, when they came to the Voyager spacecraft, they wanted to do one better. They put phonograph records on there. Gold-plated phonograph records with a cartridge and a needle in an aluminum case. And on there are drawings that how to play it, basically. Here's a circle and you go this way. You know, what they didn't understand was that any intelligent community in space is not going to play phonographs. They will at least have DVDs. So we set out these phonograph records, and the whole intent is, if somebody saw that spacecraft and they looked at that, they would say, you know, that is an obvious sign of intelligence. That couldn't possibly be random. That's not a mutant. You know, this isn't by chance. And so we always have made decisions that recognize intelligence except in one place. In anthropology and biology and evolutionary theory and thought. And the most complex thing there is, our human brain, is obviously a product of simple chance. And so they find this creature, this little hobbit creature. It's got creases in the brain. It's got lobes in the brain. It's got elephant cowboy boots. And it had to be there by chance. But the boots, I'm sure they made those themselves. There has to be there a bias. There has to be a desire. I do not want a God because I do not want to obey him. I do not want to be subject to him. I will do as I please. It is built in. And it is the basis for so much of what comes now across as science in this society in which we live. Psalm 14 and verse number 1. My sarcasm in regard to what is so-called science is not a reflection on the fact that indeed somebody out there might truly be sincere. But even that sincerity is based on the teachings of people who are driven to ignore God at any cost. Look at what the Bible describes. Psalm 14, verse 1. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. The fool. They're corrupt. They've done abominable works. There's none who does good. Those who deny God and those who refuse to recognize God's hand in his creation. Those who will look at a rock chip and say it's intelligence and a skull and skeleton and residue and say that is by chance. The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there's any who understand who seek God. They have all turned aside. They have together become corrupt. There is none who does good, no, not one. Now it does follow down through and it talks about his people and it talks about those who have been called to serve him. It talks about captivity being brought back and salvation. So the point is not that there will never be anyone there, but it's in the context of those indeed who would say there is no God. I want to read you one of the answers that was on the Edge website that was by a neuroscientist from Stanford University and also an author. Of course, all the faculty have to be authors to be able to be faculty. They have to publish or perish, as they say. He says, My argument would be that there is no God or gods or such a thing as a soul. He goes through and says, the God concept gets infuriating when you spend your time thinking about, say, untreatably aggressive childhood leukemia. You know, when you begin to talk about why things happen the way they do, then it's infuriating to even imagine the concept of God in the process of that. But then he gives away, I think, a little more openly, not mistakenly, but intentionally. He does say, finally, because again, his remarks are broader than this, I might even continue to believe there is no God, even if it were proven that there is one. So he said, beside the fact that I don't like the way things are run, even if somebody could prove it, he says, I still might not accept it. Now that's pretty open, and that's pretty straight. And you know what? I believe indeed he means it. I believe it is true. What's the difference between an atheist, someone who does not believe in God, an agnostic, someone who isn't sure, and a Christian hypocrite? Not much. Because none of them are indeed responsive to the creator and designer of this universe. In some way, each one of them still rejects the argument of intelligent design in regard to law. They still do not submit themselves to God's hand. I thought it was interesting. I worked on this over the last week. I worked on it last night. I get up and I open the paper this morning, and there was an article on The Hobbit, and then there was an article here mentioning intelligent design by my friend Ellen Goodman. I suppose I read Ellen Goodman the way liberals listen to Rush Limbaugh. I don't know how else to draw the analogy. I think it's interesting. She always has a way to chip away at any social structure, any obedience, any conservative, and I don't mean politically in that sense. Obviously, politically is part of the issue in her respect. I mean conservative in the sense of not progressive, in the sense of throwing out anything that truly has ever existed. But she reminds us that Cecil B. DeMille is the one who went around promoting his movie, The Ten Commandments, and working through the Eagles, giving away plaques that ended up on all the courthouse lawns. And so she says, well, you know, it is truly Hollywood's problem that we have a cultural divide. Of course, it was Cecil B. DeMille because he gave out these Ten Commandments monuments. She speaks rather disrespectfully of the Supreme Court, calling them the Supremes, like the singing group or something, the Supremes. So that was kind of a backhanded slap. We'll have to decide whether putting the commandments in public spaces amounts to a state endorsement of religion, or whether it's merely an acknowledgement of their historic influence on the law. She mentions Justice Antonin Scalia, who says, I bet that 90% of the American people believe in the Ten Commandments, and 85% couldn't tell you what they are. She liked that. You know, she liked, because now she can take a slap, and but it's true. You know, whatever the numbers are, I don't know, but the concept is true. She says, the whole Ten Commandments furor is fueled by religious conservatives and then handed to lawyers to offer a secular defense. You see, intelligent design is designed as a secular defense. Because by the proponents of secular design, some of the people actually think, well, maybe it's space aliens. We're not going to differentiate between a super Martian and a God being. It's just a matter of intelligence. We just want to argue, is there indeed intelligent design? Intelligence does not just happen. It is already there. She says, this reminds me of the convoluted arguments over evolution. Old-fashioned biblical creationism is presented to courts and school communities in the secular and pseudo-scientific garb of intelligent design. Some of creationism is indeed pseudoscientific. I won't deny that. Some of it is indeed true. The Kentucky lawyer actually told the justices that references to God in the commandments were minimal. Of course, the most conservative member of the court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, sticking up for law, ha ha, if you know the dynamics of the court. This prompted Ruth Bader Ginsburg to ask if he'd actually read the first four. He's saying that the reference to God are minimal. She says, well, have you read the first four? You know, obviously love God. You know, it's a rather amazing process. The people who are throwing out law are attacking the ones who are, you know, on defensive law, and it's a game. It's a game. Let's be serious. I am the Lord thy God, Ellen now speaking, is not a secular phrase. Well, hear, hear. Is that amazing or what? But she says this, either you admit that the Ten Commandments on public turf can make an important religious statement, or you pretend they're a piece of secular history. You can either be unconstitutional, or you can be a hypocrite. That's interesting, because she's arguing that you can't have any religious in this life by our Constitution. That is not true. But her point is that those people who are fighting for the Ten Commandments in many respects are hypocrites, because they don't do what the Ten Commandments say anyway. Now, she doesn't want to do what they say. She makes it very clear. But she doesn't want anybody else claiming that she has to do what they say either. Again, at the basis of our society is a absolute hatred for the law of God. A refusal to be subject to it, and therefore they cannot possibly recognize God as the Creator, or they would have to also recognize His law as His word and be subject to it. All the arguments of evolution, all the denials of creation boil down to one point. It is a denial of God's law. It is a denial of the authority of God to regulate human behavior. Even the Big Bang theory that is popularly accepted in scientific circles requires the existence of law to be in place for the Big Bang to bang out in the right way. And those laws didn't just materialize, they had to actually regulate, even according to the theory, those things that take place. They calculate back to the smallest possible fraction of a second based on what they understand to be the law of the universe. Evolution and the arguments thereof, the denials of creation and the arguments thereof are at their root a denial of God's law. Psalm 148, verse number 4. Says, praise the Lord from creation, the title at the head of this in my New King James, but no, verse 4. Praise Him, you heaven of heavens, and you waters above the heavens. Let them praise the name of the Lord, for He commanded, and they were created. He has also established them forever and ever. He has made a decree which shall not pass away. A decree, in that sense, is His word. It's the law. It's His instruction. It's His command. He has made a decree in the course of the creation which shall not pass away. Isaiah 48, verse number 12. Verse 12 and 13. Listen to me, O Jacob, and Israel, my called. I am He, I am the first, I am also the last. Indeed, my hand has laid the foundation of the earth. My right hand has stretched out the heavens. They are where God wants them to be. When you begin to read through some of the arguments on intelligent design, and it begins to analyze in terms of what is out there in the universe, and if it was different, life could not exist. If the force of gravity was more or less, if the expansion rate of the universe was more or less. And they will go down through 24, 26 lists of different properties. That if these things were different, then the difference in the chemical properties, the difference in the structure of the planets and the stars and the universe would be fundamentally different. And life, as we know it even here, would not exist. Then you boil that down to the Earth, if it was closer or further away, or if the tilt was different, or if the spin was different, or if the moon was bigger, and it goes on and on forever. It is a remarkable process that God has put in place, but He says He laid them out by His hand. It says, indeed, my hand has laid the foundation of the earth, my right hand has stretched out the heavens. When I call to them, they stand up together. Just again, reference to God's hand in putting everything exactly in place. And because He did that, and He had the power to do that, we become subject to Him because He created us, and we become subject to His word and to His law. Isaiah 45 in verse number 18. There was one specific reason why all of this took place. One reason. Thus says the Lord, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who has established it. He did not create it in vain. It wasn't empty. It wasn't without purpose. He formed it, or who formed it, to be inhabited. The purpose of the whole creation was indeed where the earth could be inhabited, because God is reproducing himself. And he laid this all out for that specific reason. I am the Lord, and there is no other. I have not spoken in secret in a dark place of the earth. I did not say to the seed of Jacob, seek me in vain. I, the Lord, speak righteousness. I declare things that are right. It's estimated, and I've heard different estimates, but this would be the high end of any I have seen. It's estimated that in the observable universe, there is not any more than a trillion galaxies. That's a bunch. I don't know what a trillion is. But it's just estimated, again, no more than a trillion. It's something less than that in the observable universe. And they also have gone out there and they've counted all the stars in various universes, and they average that out. Well, they estimate. So they estimate that each of the galaxies probably averages about 100 billion stars. So let's just say, you got 100 billion stars, and you have a trillion galaxies. So you multiply the one times the other, and I don't know what that comes out to. You got a goo goo gig or something. It's way, way out there. It's a big, big number. And we don't even know how to count to that. And then they take the odds of, if they analyze all of the things it takes for life to exist, and if life was to exist simply by chance, in one single place, in the entire universe, what are the odds of it happening are not big enough for life to even happen in one place. With, like say, numbers that we cannot hardly understand, 100 billion times a trillion. And with all the possibilities out there, the odds are so large of life at random mutation or circumstance or combination of elements or whatever it takes of that happening in random way. The odds are not even where that would happen in one place. Now, science turns that around. And they say, well, we're not so much worried about the odds. We're here. And so that's all it takes. We're here. So since we're here, and we're not thinking about the odds of if indeed that was reasonable or not in that same sense, then let's take a little different analogy. What would we suppose from the fact that we are here then? What is it that should come to our mind when we look at the creation, when we look at all of the universe that we are able to see? Somebody commits a crime to which the penalty is death. And they tie him to a stake, and they bring out the firing squad to shoot the individual and execute him for his crime. This is an analogy that was used in one of the texts. Sharpshooters, these are professional riflemen, and there's 100 of them, and they line them up, and at the command, they all aim at the individual who's tied to the stake, and they fire, and the prisoner survives. Do you think the prisoner said, ha, what luck? Every single one of them must have missed. Or do you think the prisoner would stop and say, you know, there indeed must be a reason why I was allowed to live? Do you think, even on the scale of 100, that every single one of them, expert in their job, could not fulfill it? By the same rationale, the only reasonable conclusion for man, when he looks at the universe, when he looks at the world around us and all that we are able to see, is that God has indeed purposed that we should live as well. There is no rational reason, indeed, that this would simply take place by chance.